Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the Jahar Tsarnaev cover controversy shows no signs of dying down. Public officials trash the magazine. Stores refuse to sell it. The bulk of the public appear disgusted, but have they actually read it? We have. And then it's our Ask The segment with the new Commissioner of Public Health. She'll answer our questions and yours about ticks, mosquitoes, childhood obesity, and how to deal with dangers of heat, Marjorie.
Christopher Lydon on hot, steamy summer reading. The latest from the Whitey Bulger trial, including the sudden death of a key witness in that trial. Karen Miller on a Wharton professor who publishes nonstop, mentors nonstop, believes helping everyone who asks is the key to getting ahead. I'm wondering why he has time for just a cup of coffee. Those conversations are next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie. What do you say? It's a scorcher?
Scorcher.
It's a scorcher. It's a scorcher.
Yeah.
You know, rarely has a magazine cover provoked such anger. The firestorm over Rolling Stone's cover of Jahar Tsarnaev, at least to me, shows no sign of dying down. The mayor is enraged. You've heard Tom Menino. Most chain stores won't sell it. Social media is exploding. And I think I'm right when I say, with the exception of a lone Globe columnist, that's Yvonne Abraham, and an editorial there, and a lone Herald columnist, that would be Marjorie Egan, taking another view. What kind of feedback have you gotten saying that the cover was appropriate?
I would say it's about 90% against me, Jim.
How viciously against you?
Well, I mean, you know, there are tough commenters in the Herald. People are, as you would say, appalled. They think that this was totally disrespectful, totally disgraceful, that the victim's story should have been on the front cover of Rolling Stone, that the first responder's story should have been on the front cover of Rolling Stone. I just got an email here from one of our listeners saying, oh, Marjorie, what happened to you? Formerly your biggest fan. That's from Dick, who
of victims, and people mentioned this yesterday, there's one line out of 11,000 words in the whole piece that mentions victims. It mentions an 8-year-old victim. It says others, hundreds were injured, never mentions any names. So for those who have focused on that, it is about the Tsarnaevs and the world in which they grew up or in Cambridge. But we want to ask you, where are you the day after? Are you angry? If you are, have you actually taken the time to read the 11,000 word piece we did, and by the way, we invited Janet Reitman, the writer, to join us. She's unavailable today. We're going to try to get her tomorrow. And do you support the decision of places like CVS, Tedeschi's, and others to refuse to sell the magazine so that essentially if people want to read it, unless they do it online, they don't have that opportunity? 877-301-897. You know what the sense I get of this, and I don't want to get people more aggravated than they are, is you know when people say that those book banning types talk about how hard this book can't sell here, and of course they've never read the book.
Right.
In an informal poll from trolling some talk radio stations this morning, the vast majority of people, when they're asked, did you read the 11,000-word article before you trash
it? It's long.
Oh, it is really, really long. The vast majority of people have not. And we're particularly interested, if there are those of you who have read the piece, which Marjorie and I both think is a pretty decent piece with a lot of new information, which we'll share with you in case you haven't, or at least some of the information we'll share with you. It's pretty hard to say the cover is wildly inappropriate if you don't know what the cover is matched to. If it was inside with some sensational celebrity crap a la People Magazine, or actually Us Magazine, which is owned, I believe, by the same company that owns Rolling Stone, that's one thing. This is a pretty serious piece talking about the world, particularly in which Jahar grew up in Cambridge with his parents, without his parents, his friends, his wrestling coach, some signs of the transition in him. And most of the stuff, most of the most telling things, I have to say, I had not read before. What is the piece about the discussion a friend of his has about the about 9/11 with, I believe, his friend Will?
Well, that he, at one point, and this is a little peek into what Jahar began to be thinking around 2011, 2012, he didn't want to talk with his friends about the 9/11 attacks because he knew they wouldn't like his view. But he thought that some acts of terrorism were justified because of what the United States does in other countries. And that was what he said about the United States dropping bombs all the time. Obviously, that's not what the vast majority of Americans think, and he didn't talk about that much with friends. Here's what I thought was significant about this article. There's a Chechenian friend who befriended the family when they came here, and she talks about how the parents seemed to be very, very much in love. The kids were, she called them like cuddly kittens, all four kids hugging and kissing each other. We go from there to obviously a parent's relationship that falls apart, a father who's really trying hard to make it in the United States and he can't, get so frustrated and his health is going that he goes back home to Russia.
And, well, not only frustrated that he can't make it, frustrated with the fact that his wife and one of his kids is becoming more dedicated to a severe strain of Islam.
You learn that Tamerlan seemed to be a god in this family. What Tamerlan said went. He's the eldest brother. You learn that that this same friend that called at one point called them cuddly kittens was told by the mother that Tamerlan was acting odd and thought he had two people inside him, like he had mental health problems. The friend said he should see a psychiatrist. The mother would have none of that. She didn't even mention the word the friend psychiatrist because she knew how much it would upset the mother. And the mother's solution was for them to go deeper and deeper into Islam. What is also significant is you see the Tamerlan becoming more and more radicalized. We knew that. What I think is so significant about this article is that this woman, this reporter, has gone out and talked to tons of friends in Cambridge, people who knew this kid quite well, how they saw none of this, except these little inklings where he mentioned things like 9/11. There was a talk about there. It was a class at Cambridge in Latin where they discussed terrorism quite openly. And Johar was not saying, defending terrorism in that class. So that was significant. She really tries hard to show the transformation, but she doesn't succeed in showing what it was that turned this kid.
And she tells a story. And by the way, for those who are worried, as I assume a lot of you are, and I share this, that this was not just an explainer, a story, but was a sort of explaining it away, that his parents left, he missed his father, poor Johar. I didn't get any of that. I got the fact that this woman did, I think so far, the most thorough retelling of what this 19-year-old person accused of murder and many other things, what his life was like after he came to America.
Well, the parents did in some way. There's a line in there about there was a senior night at Cambridge Ridge in Latin when every wrestler is asked to bring a parent or relative to walk them onto the gym floor to receive a flower and have their picture taken. No one showed up for Johar. His friends mentioned over and over again they never met his parents. Never
coach
met
walked
big,
out with him, by
his
the
big
way.
Brother. The coach walked out, and the coach, was very favorable to Johar in this argument, in this piece. And you also
Be careful here. Favorable to him when describing what he was like when he was on his team.
Well,
he was alleged murderer.
No one anywhere is defending. I mean, this is a monstrous thing. This kid, a twisted, sick thing. We all know that this kid did. But I think what this article does, too, is show the circumstances in which the parents had gone back to Russia. Johar, who was a smart kid, got into Northeastern, got into other schools, wanted to go to Tufts or Brandeis, didn't have the money, ended up going to UMass Dartmouth, was unhappy there. Every weekend that campus clears out. And so he cleared out, too, and went back to Cambridge. And the only person back in Cambridge then was wacky older brother, who was becoming more and more, obviously, of a nut.
What'd you take away from the fact that his dream schools, as we call them, included Brandeis? What
was
the first thing that occurred to you?
Brandeis is probably 60% Jewish.
Jewish, yeah.
I thought that was very interesting for a kid that was more and more embracing his Muslim roots. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. There's also a very chilling last paragraph. There was a story in The Globe about the nurses that had cared for Johar in Beth Israel Hospital and how it was difficult because, of course, they were victims of the bombings on the other floors. And this was the bomber here. And by the way, they called him the bomber on the front page, not the alleged bomber, but the bomber, which is, he's
on the cover of Rolling Stone. Yeah.
And there's the nurses did not mention this in the story, but according to the reporter, one of the nurses had said that Johar cried for 2 days straight after he woke up in the hospital. But no one knew what he was crying about. Was he crying about what he'd done?
Sure.
Was he crying about his brother being dead? Was he crying about getting caught? Who knows?
Rolling Stone also has not helped itself. I'm sure you've all read this. There's a senior editor who tweeted the following. His name is Christian Horde. He apologized after the fact, but he's dumb enough to have put it out to begin with. After the initial uproar, said, "I guess we should have drawn and then he uses the word as slang for the male organ on Johar's face or something. I mean, that creates this notion about Rolling Stone that that feeds a lot of people's anger. In any case, we want to know where you are. It's 24 hours after the fact. There's an 11,000-word piece, which we hope people are reading, particularly if you are as angry as the vast majority of people seem to be about this. 877-301-8970. Let's start in Milton with Paul. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I read the entire piece online yesterday, and you could see the threat of destruction going back to the 1700s. If you read the Chechnya Russian, I mean, it did remind me an awful lot of the IRA battles, and I think they referred to that.
They do.
In the article, and you wonder.
They refer to it by saying there are a lot of Irish in Boston who had never been to Ireland, who had this incredibly deep feeling and connection to the IRA.
The terrorists in the IRA.
And he's talking, and in the piece, Janet Reitman writes about the allegiance that so many Chechnyans felt to the Chechnyan separatist movement, even though they'd never been there. But go ahead, Paul.
Or weren't really technically, you know, from that part of the country. I mean, the father was not.
I mean, I thought it was very enlightening, and I'm sorry that people are distracted by the cover. Perhaps, you know, they're right. I mean, it was a cover that they put on, obviously, to sell the magazine. But
which incidentally is what every magazine does with every cover. You know, this is one of these rare circumstances, Paul. I said it yesterday, and I feel it still today after having read the thing. There are two sides of the story. This is not a slam dunk that the cover is fine or that it's wildly inappropriate. There are two intelligent sides of this. But, you know, Yvonne Abraham, what's Yvonne Abraham's opening line in her piece?
She can't work up the outrage
other
people are feeling about
the
cover.
And I have to say, I'm pretty much where he were. Your piece is great, too, Marjorie. Paul, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
But you know what I think one of the other dilemmas is here, that this was a self-portrait. And that he did himself. He took a picture of himself, a selfie, as Tiber calls it in the Globe, or the kids call it, because a lot of these kids do it themselves. And it is sort of a come-hither photograph. But frankly, it's not much different from a lot of the other photographs you've seen of him. And I think one of the problems for us is you want people who do terrible things to look terrible. Mm-hmm. And I saw him in the federal courthouse. This is what he looks like.
When he was arraigned a week or so ago.
Yeah, this is what he looks like. I mean, there are other pictures that may be less soulful. It's been described as soulful. But a lot of the pictures of him in going at the prom, his graduation with his graduation gown on, a flower in his lapel, he looks like a kid. And I think that's upsetting to people.
You know, the New York Times, it was mentioned yesterday by our guest at the top of the show, this exact same photograph appeared on the front page of the New York Times. We looked at it this morning. It's roughly a half of the top of the paper above the fold. And the unlike the situation in the Rolling Stone, which begins with dark letters, the bomber, and ends with the word monster, the New York Times under the photo said the dark side carefully masked. And the subheading was bombing suspect hit a troubled Second Life. But I assume the reason there wasn't that level of outrage then was because it was the New York Times, as opposed to what is generally seen as a declining music magazine. Let's go to Ashley in the car on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hey there, Ashley.
Hey, Marjorie and Jim. I just wanted to say I did read the Rolling Stone article, and I really do think they did a good job of explaining how this kid got from point A to what we know about him now.
Right.
But it's the picture. I mean, it looks like Cat Stevens in the 1970s on a Rolling Stone cover.
Does look like Cat Stevens, actually. That's a very good one.
There's this great one back. I was looking at all these Rolling Stone covers yesterday. There was three great pictures of Bob Dylan in 68, 74, and 78. It looked a lot like Bob Dylan in some of those pictures, too. I don't know why the people are doing the Jim Morrison thing, because I don't think it looks anything like
Jim
Morrison.
Brian McGrory from the Boston Globe, the editor yesterday, said it looked like Jim Morrison. Then he admitted he had no idea what Jim Morrison looked like. But so, Ashley, you come down with the piece was worth reading, but they should have either not put him on the cover or done another photo.
I don't even care if they use this photo on the cover, but even if they did it more like the Time magazine with Obama, his half face, how did this kid go from this than a selfie to in handcuffs on the ground or a picture of him in court? I'm not saying he needs to be bloodied and demonized, but, you know, if we could have just, how did we get from point A to
point B?
Can I
tell you something? That would have been a far more provocative cover than what they had. That is brilliant. Ashley, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it. What, you know, that wouldn't have at all have taken away from what they were wanting to do. Their whole point is, how did this, what do they call him, charming, sweet kid become a monster? Well, how about having that evolution on the cover in a picture? It's brilliant.
Well, and especially since when he was in court last week, his whole face was swollen on the left-hand side and his mouth was was not normal, twisted and lopsided, it would have shown, you know, the visual difference between him before the horrible crime.
But, of course, there are no cameras in the courtroom, even though in a Russian news story, which we have all spotted on, a Russian news story, which we've all seen, a Russian reporter took a video of the screen in the media overflow room, which had Tsarnaev on it, even though it wasn't a close-up.
And that's another thing. What people who didn't or were not able to go down to the courtroom saw were these pictures that looked nothing like him. Let's go to Carolyn in Worcester. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just going to comment on the cover because I haven't read the article, and I'm sure it is wonderful because Rolling Stone usually, you know, does good pieces on issues. However, I think this is lookism at its worst. I mean, I don't know if you'd be able to put a picture of Adam Lanza, the killer in Newtown, on their cover.
Saying because Adam Lanza isn't as appealing looking as Tsarnaev,
by leaps and bounds, and this kid is adorable.
That's an interesting point, Carolyn.
But you know what, Carolyn? I see it differently. Adam Lanza, I think most of us would agree, had serious mental health problems. Yeah. So you know the reason that you know, he was caught up. He was mentally ill, and he was caught up in this. There's no mystery. There's no mystery about Jared Loughner, the shooter in the Gabby Giffords case. You know, Newtown, Aurora, all these people. Holmes, again, mental illness. The guy down in Virginia Tech, mental illness. But this was not a mentally ill young man, and therein lies the question, I think.
Well, I think they could have couched it in, I think, a less provocative way in the cover. I just get the feeling that it was deliberate.
Well, it was clearly, there's no question it was deliberate, and I think they wanted this dialogue to happen. And my guess is, we don't know this yet, I don't think it's out till tomorrow, my guess is they end up selling more issues of Rolling Stone, despite all the people that say they would never buy it and never intended to subscribe again. Carolyn, thanks for the call. 877-301-8970. The mayor, I'm sure you heard, the mayor wrote a letter to the editor.
Yep.
Of I don't know if it was Jan Wenner. I don't know who he wrote to, but a leader at Rolling Stone. I had the governor on last night, and he was troubled by it, but was not. He didn't seem nearly as impassioned as the mayor has. And obviously, virtually every one of these convenience stores, almost without exception, I think virtually every major chain, Tedeschi's, CVS, I can't think of the others,
Walgreens
as well, have decided not to carry this thing. And I appreciate it. Do you think they're doing that as a matter of principle, or they're doing it because they're concerned that their customers are going to be enraged if they come in and see this guy's face out of the magazine stand?
I don't know. I mean, you could be cynical and say it's a good marketing thing. You want to look like you're totally on board with the suffering that's gone on here. I don't know. I don't know what their motives are. Maybe they're good motives. By the way, I didn't mean to say before, we have pictures in the courtroom. We have just drawings of Tsarnaev in the courtroom. And that's the problem.
Well, they're surely not going to put a drawing on the...
But they're drawings, and that is not
fair. Say look nothing at all for the most part.
I don't
part.
Think they look anything like him. And I think it's... Think about this. That the people... You know, there are 260 people that were injured here and many people that were just there. Those people are not going to be able to see this trial unless they take a day off from work. Suppose they live in California.
Well,
they live
the point
in Chicago.
Your column, yeah, that's a great point.
They can't see this trial. They have to physically, when people who can't
that
even
is a fabulous
drive.
Point. Forget the general public for a moment.
Yes,
that is a great
they
point.
They are learning to walk, and they can't. They have to go physically to the trial. It just drives me out.
Paul, you know, also the irony about, I don't mean to obsess on our obsession, cameras in the courtroom, but we learned today they're scanning all of our license plates and keeping them forever. We know what they're doing with our email and our phone calls. So the government can watch everything we do, but we can't watch a trial that the government is prosecuting. It's insane. Bill on the Cape, you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thank you for your call.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks, Jim and Marjorie.
Sure.
To me, it's just the way they did the cover, the way they presented this kid on the cover. I don't care. I would never pick up that magazine and even try to read that article. I think Ashley had it right. And I think that it sounds like the people who have read the article describe it as some sort of glamorization of this kid, this poor innocent cherub. And the kid's a little bastard. He should hang.
Well, I have to say, let me say something, Bill. I read the whole thing, and I read it pretty carefully, and I was worried that they were going to paint this picture of this sweet kid, which they do in some part, And I was worried that I'd end up feeling some sympathy for him. I felt none at all. It didn't disabuse me of my feelings of anger that everybody has about what he allegedly was involved in on April 15th. But, you know, that's me, and it could be different. And, Bill, we appreciate your point of view. Thank you so much for the call. By the way, we've mentioned Tom and Eno before. Here he is, Tom and Eno, yesterday responding orally to the Rolling Stone cover.
I think it's a total disgrace that cover the Rolling Stones. Should have been about the survivors, the first responders. Why are we glorifying a guy who created mayhem in the city of Boston?
You know, one of the interesting things, as I mentioned earlier, that in the story, 11,000 words, there is literally one sentence, maybe two, but one or two sentences, very brief, mentioning an 8-year-old victim, not mentioning the name of the 8-year-old victim, Martin Richard, and it mentions that others were killed and that 200 and some people were injured or maimed, never mentions the names. I don't know if it's a sidebar, because we don't have the actual magazine. All we have is the story itself.
Yeah.
But I have to say that if they don't do anything more on the victims there, even if they felt it was inappropriate for the core story, that is pretty pathetic. I mean, that really is pretty pathetic. There's room for both. Would you not argue?
There is absolutely room for both. I think though, what the importance to me of this article is that, as I said before, this is our future, unfortunately, worrying about these lone wolves.
The kid next door.
Yes, that are inspired.
Or the man next
door,
the woman next
door. And by the way,
yeah.
If people don't know this, the latest issue of Al-Qaeda's magazine, Inspire, which in fact was the article that Tsarnaev's learned how to make a bomb from, is dedicated to the two brothers. It's got this picture of Tamerlan looking like he's in heaven.
In the clouds, right?
Doves and sunbeams all around him. And those are that magazine is, you know, a required reading for people that are planning on a future plots against America, wherever else, not to mention all these jihadist websites. And so I think it's important to find out how these kids do go from A to B, because I'd like to prevent them getting to B in the future.
But, you know, a caller said a minute ago, I think it was Ashley, who had the great cover idea that it does get us from A to B. It doesn't really get us from
A
to B. It tells the story of A. It tells the story of B, or maybe C, let's call it. But there's no connection, and I'm not faulting the writer for it, but what you're hoping for when you read this is, after reading the story of what he was like, the better Jahar, and knowing what he was like as the horrible Jahar, that all the connections be made, and all there are hints of what happened.
Well, this FBI guy that she's quoted in the story that does a lot of trying to figure out a behavioral analysis unit of the FBI talks about leakage. And what he means by that is when you see a tiny crack in this otherwise carefully crafted facade. And the leakage in the younger Tsarnaev brothers case, he says, when he mentioned things like he thought 9/11 might have been an inside job, or, you know, Americans all hate Muslims and that kind of stuff. But he said it's really, really difficult, even when you've been doing it your whole life, as he has in a counterterrorism group, to get inside somebody's head. And, you know, I can't fault the reporter for not being able to do what an FBI 30-year veteran says is very difficult to do. Marilyn from Watertown, thank you for calling. Hi, Marilyn.
I'm glad to have you back, Marjorie and Jim.
Oh, thank you.
I have a couple of things I'd like to say. First of all, I really believe that people, these murderers, should not be, you know, shown anywhere on TV, say their name, or in a magazine, because you get anyone with a mental, you know, disability who's going to be hero. The other thing is,
well, before you leave that point, by the way, there's somebody I think Marjorie and I respect a lot, James Fox, who writes a blog for The Globe, is a criminologist at Northeastern, who agrees with you. He's not saying you shouldn't report on the crimes, but the constant imagery and the constant storytelling may do exactly what you're describing. But go ahead.
Absolutely. And I didn't hear that. But I've got to tell you, as a Watertown resident, you know, I've learned from experience, you don't believe everything you read. And I'm not going to read that magazine. But they have said publicly that in that story, they're saying that his coach got him from the boat. I'm from Watertown, and that was not
No, that's not what they say. What they say is the coach was called by, I think it was an FBI person or police, after they got him out of the boat, because the coach had made a public plea once he realized it was Jahar, his former wrestler, to surrender. And I believe that what they say in the story, the FBI person, others, says it's very possible that your plea may have had some impact on this. I'm not sure. They're not suggesting his coach got him out of the boat.
No, they're not. And FBI, the piece says that the FBI, some guy invoked the coach's name while speaking with Zahar and think it might have helped. But they did not report that the coach was actually there.
But thank you for the call. Let's take one more, Marjorie, if we can.
Let's go to Aziz from Worcester. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, you know, the first part of what you said today about a lot of people not actually reading a magazine, just because of the front cover. I think people should get curious about learning about why an innocent kid like this would do something that drastic.
Yeah.
Also, I also believe what the caller said, the last two callers said about having that picture in the front of the Rolling Stones magazine might actually make more people that might want to be thinking about doing the same thing do it. So maybe the Rolling Stones is not the best magazine to talk about things like that, but I think as Americans, everybody should be curious as to what happened. Yes, it's a horrible thing, I mean, but where did we get it wrong? You know, where did it all go wrong?
Yeah, well, that's you're right. That's the big, huge mystery. The unanswered question is how you did get from A to B or A to C, and you wonder about all the people that are in that situation.
And again, we tried today to get Janet Reitman, who wrote this piece, and we have reinitiated our request. Our hope is we will get her tomorrow. We'll obviously let you know.
Okay, every week we invite public officials on to take your calls. So today we've got Cheryl Bartlett, the Massachusetts Public Health Commissioner. She's going to join us to take your calls on ticks, mosquitoes, the heat, whatever other public health concerns you may have. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Once a month, it's Ask the Governor. In between, we ask another public official to come by. Today, it's the new Commissioner of Public Health. She's here to take our questions and yours on the heat, on ticks, on mosquitoes, on combating obesity. Cheryl Bartlett is the new, as they say, Massachusetts Public Health Commissioner. Congratulations and nice to see you, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Nice to see you too, Cheryl. Thank you for coming in. So I don't know if you've noticed, but it is a little warm outside.
I noticed.
Yeah. So how dangerous is this? I mean, it's going to continue tomorrow and possibly into Saturday.
It is definitely potentially dangerous, particularly for elderly or folks that have any kind of chronic condition. And so precautions are really in order.
What are the obvious two or three things that everybody should be doing, not just obviously people are most vulnerable? What are the two or three things public health types like you are recommending to people?
So avoiding strenuous activity, because that takes...
I avoid it every day, but what's okay? It's never been an issue.
Particularly
with me.
Okay. Now, you should avoid it. Drinking a lot of water to remain hydrated, trying to stay in cool places. And probably the most important thing is we can think about checking on our neighbors, those that are elderly and homebound.
Because it would seem to me, I mean, I joked yesterday about even leaving the air conditioner on for the dog because it's so hot in the house. But really, if you don't have an air conditioner, fans are not really going to do it in this kind of weather, are they?
Well, they won't necessarily cool you down, but they will help to dry perspiration that can help alleviate some of the heat effects. But being on a lower level in your home so that there's less heat rises. And again, being in shade, there are public places in some communities. There are cooling centers.
How about pools? Is it DCR
community?
That's in charge of? I don't know who's in
yes.
charge of pools. Are they open
some
longer,
pools.
Or what's the deal with these state pools, city pools? What's going on with that?
I think you probably have to check town by town. Those are town policies. I think that there are some places where they're getting out your hose and hosing down your pets and your kids.
When did you? How recently did you start?
I started on the 26th of June. I had been acting for about 6 weeks prior to that.
I assume part of your briefing when you were being considered for the job, I assume you were briefed on the legendary Marjorie Egan wet sheet technique for staying cool. Was that taught to you? Or was
no.
Do you want to share that with the commissioner? Because I think she'd want to use that.
Everyone ridicules me for this, but it does work. If you're going to do the whole elaborate thing, what you do is you take your sheets and your pillowcases, you put them in the washing machine on cold. cold, you take them off wet and put them on your bed. Everybody thinks that's gross and it's clammy. In fact, and when I did not have an air conditioner, actually, I still don't in my bedroom on the third floor. You do that, or if you want to do it halfway, you just spray the sheets and spray the pillowcase. Get them all wet, and you get in, and it's kind of like you're sleeping in an air-conditioned room.
Now, nice. Commissioner, do you want to ridicule that, or what is your...
I'm a nurse, and so one of the things that we've done when people are overheated in nursing and first aid is actually to put a cool cloth on your forehead or around your neck, and those are things that definitely help to alleviate some of the heat symptoms.
See that, Jen?
So, I did.
She's a nurse.
I understand.
She
I know exactly
ridiculous.
What she is. Her name is Cheryl Bartlett.
Whole body cooling,
she is
Jen.
The brand new Massachusetts Public Health Commissioner. She's here to answer your questions and ours. Our number is 877-301-8970. Anything in her bailiwick is part of the discussion. We're particularly interested in heat and ticks and mosquitoes and the state's campaign to combat at least childhood obesity, which I am obsessed with.
Well, before we get to childhood obesity, which you are obsessed with, I read in the Globe the other day the story about in Maine how they have hired sharpshooters to go out and shoot deer because of the Lyme disease becoming an epidemic, and that Lyme disease is becoming an epidemic here in Massachusetts. No one is proposing sharpshooting deers here that you know of, Commissioner, have they?
I have not heard that, but in some places where there's a large deer population, the conversation has taken place. I lived many years on Nantucket, and they have a particularly high incidence of Lyme disease, and a discussion of adding extra hunting time to the deer season has been discussed, but there are proponents and opponents.
They say
that
in that article in the Globe, by the way, they went on to say that, well, it was very controversial. Once it was adopted, and I think they killed 100 deer or
something. Yeah, 100 deer.
They say they virtually eradicated the problem. Speaking, how serious is the problem? I mean, we all read about it. We all read about the impact of these deer ticks and what the crippling effect they can have on people. How bad are things now? What is the state of things, Commissioner?
Well, Lyme disease is certainly spreading across the state of Massachusetts and in more places in the country. It used to be more concentrated in coastal communities. So as the deer population increases and moves around, we certainly are seeing more cases of it. In most cases, if you check yourself every day and you notice that you have a tick on you, if you remove it right away, in most cases, you won't go on to have Lyme disease.
How do you remove it? The controversy has always been, whenever I've been in the presence of someone with a tick, how do you remove it? Some say burn it out. Some say tweeze it out.
Right.
What's the technique here?
I think the advised way is to use tweezers and try to just pull the tick straight out and remove it. There are a lot of different old wives' tales about ways of doing it, but I think the tweezer is
But I think of that as regular ticks, you know, the kind that we've all known for years.
Right.
These Lyme ticks
are
the size of a head of a pin.
Right.
You know, I know several people who've gotten Lyme disease. Nobody ever saw the tick. How do you find a tick on you that's the size of a pinhead? You know, you'd be looking all day, especially if you're freckled like me. You wouldn't be able
right.
to tell.
We're recommending when you're in the shower to really feel your skin. You can actually feel them. There'll be a little bump that you might feel
so
in
this
it.
So this is after they've begun to burrow in.
Yes.
Okay.
Now,
check for bumps
I mentioned
now.
That I'm, we'll get to your calls in a second at 877-301-8970. I mentioned that I'm obsessed with childhood obesity as a formerly fat little boy. What Marjorie is obsessed with are mosquitoes. And when there was I'll never forget, we were on the radio on another station maybe 4 or 5 years ago when there was a graphic in the Globe of where Ground Zero was for
That's
West
right.
Nile. And it was about a block from her house. She did not want to come to the radio station. We have only found, is it true that one mosquito carrying West Nile so far this year? Is that what the state of affairs is?
Well, I believe we may be up to a handful by today. As of yesterday, there were two identified, but I'm just reading an email as I was in your waiting room and think that they may have found a few more.
Is that cause for worry?
I
mean, people
Not
are
yet.
Saying because it was so wet and then it was so hot, it obviously creates a particularly egregious breeding ground for mosquitoes, but a handful is not something to cause
this
great
is
worry.
Not a critical situation at this point. We are monitoring it and tracking it, and there have been no mammal or human cases of it at this particular time, and so twice a week we really are looking at what the risk analysis is across the state.
You know, I remember seeing the picture on television of a crow. I think it was a crow that was bitten. It had West Nile
virus. I remember
this. And the crow was staggering down the street like it was drunk, you know, like that.
Yeah.
And I thought, how come a crow, because they get all that fur or hair. What do crows have? What do birds have?
Feathers, we feathers. Call them, yes.
Thank you.
Yikes.
It's not fur. It's not hair.
What's
it's
your question,
feathers.
Marjorie?
Well, how do they get how
who
they
cares,
get bitten?
Marjorie?
Who
cares
about them? Well, you worry about dogs or cats. You think of animals are protected from mosquitoes because of their fur, hair, or feathers.
Well, there are different types of mosquitoes, and some are bird biting, which is how actually the diseases are amplified. If you bite a mosquito bites a bird that's infected with West Nile or Triple E and then bites other birds, we start to increase the amount of birds that are infected. Some bite birds and bite mammals, including humans.
Can I throw two cents? Do you read this great piece in the New York Times? What day is today? The 18th? 3 days ago, a low-tech mosquito deterrent. There's this great piece by William Broad, who talks about how the best thing that he has seen are fans on tables when you're outside. And they say there are two reasons. One, because the guy who's behind this says the solution came from trying to think like a bug and realizing I don't like flying in a 15-mile-per-hour wind. But they also say since mosquitoes are drawn toward the human scent, that a small fan on a table disperses the scent. And so obviously if you're in a big backyard, this isn't going to work. But if you're sitting like on a deck or something, this does make sense, does it not, Commissioner?
I think it does. I actually bought a little ultrasonic fan for a belt that you can put on, and it has some insect repellent as well.
In the
as
thing itself?
In the thing itself.
Really?
I went to Africa in December, and I bought every mosquito protection device that existed out there.
Do you know something?
Talking to me?
I want to tell you this very quickly.
Yes.
Little fans, you know what they work great for?
What?
If you have fruit flies, you just put the fan next to the bowl of fruit, and you know those they fly right away.
I grew up with my grandfather loving the zapper on the backyard. That was our number is 877-301-8970. We'll get to this childhood obesity thing and what the state is doing about it in a minute. But there are a ton of calls, so let's take some.
Tyler from Lowell, thank you very much for calling. You're on the phone with Jim and Marjorie and the Commissioner of Public Health.
Hey there, Tyler.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent.
Good. I had a little thing to add about the ticks. I go outdoors a lot, and I get them on me all the time. And so my doctor has told me that in order to get it out safely, to minimize the risk of getting Lyme disease, and to also save the tick to bring it into the doctors to get it tested, what you should do is try to gently pull it, and if it doesn't come out, you can get rubbing alcohol, 90% or higher, and then you put it on a cotton ball. Then you take the cotton ball and hold it over the tick for about 10 minutes, and then that'll paralyze or kill the tick, and then you can just gently start pulling it out, and it'll just pop right out.
What do you think, Commissioner? Then, makes sense to you?
Makes
the head
sense.
Stays on the tick and everything.
Tyler, thanks for
sense.
The suggestion.
It
we appreciate it.
Disinfects at the same time.
Yeah, that's very good. Thank you very much. Is it Vizianne from Auburn?
Is that Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for
thank
calling.
Thank you.
I have a question for the Commissioner. I'm just concerned about global warming, so we have to keep up this wave of heat right now. And I would like to know if you should be concerned with any health issues, because my boyfriend, I think he suffered from some kind of hypothermia or something of those lines, because it's so, so hot, but his skin is so cold and he's sweating that it's so disgusting. It's not normal. So I would like to know if should I concern or bring him to the doctor or something like that.
How about that, Commissioner Borla?
Well, I would say anytime anyone is symptomatic, that going to the doctor and trying to understand why that is a good decision to make. And in terms of global warming, I think that that's a controversy in the world of environmental protection. But I think that we are seeing changes in weather pattern, no doubt about it. And obviously with that brings change in insect populations. And with that obviously comes diseases that are associated.
What makes you, Commissioner, we're going to get more of your calls in a second, 877-301-8970. What makes you most nervous in your job? I don't mean doing something, but what's the threat or the risk that being the Commissioner of Public Health, you say, God, this is the thing that's the toughest nut for us to crack here if it happens? What is that?
Well, I think every day wanting to make sure that we are keeping the public safe, healthcare safety and quality is really important. But I tend to be a worrier about everything. We have over 100 programs in the department and over 3,000 employees. So I want to make sure that we're providing the right support so that people are doing their jobs.
You're the calmest worrier I've ever seen. I mean, based upon my 15 minutes of knowing you, did you not in your early days, I guess you were acting, well, obviously you were acting commissioner at this point, you were coordinating the medical response, if I read correctly, to the Marathon bombings. Were you not?
We have the Bureau of Emergency Preparedness as one of our 10 bureaus at the department, and I was actually covering for interim Commissioner Lauren Smith while she was on vacation. So I got my first taste of being the commissioner.
What was that like for you that day when you got the call and then you realized what you had to do? What was it like?
Actually, I was driving into the department to just thank the staff for being there for the marathon as the bomb went off. So I walked into our emergency preparedness office, and honestly, it was I was so pleased to see how well preparedness training played out in Massachusetts, in Boston during this event, and how quickly we were able to get people to facilities and get treated. And so I think I was mostly impressed at how talented the coordination of emergency preparedness.
What does that mean? Where's the office that you're located in, by the way?
We are at 250 Washington Street.
Okay, so that would be a few blocks away from the finish line of the marathon, right? This would be
The Commons.
Near Downtown Crossing.
Correct.
Kind of thing. So what does it mean to coordinate the emergency response? What does that mean?
So our role is coordinating hospital preparedness and emergency preparedness, so triaging patients to hospitals, making sure that they're sort of equally divided and one hospital doesn't get overwhelmed while another hospital has capacity to act, to help hospitals coordinate internally if they need to move patients from the emergency room so that they can take more urgently treated
treatment. So your people would have been there at the front line with the EMS people, first responders saying, send this person to Beth Israel, send this person to the Brigham or whatever, something like that.
And they were reporting back into our headquarters to tell us what they were seeing on the ground and how things were going so we could then alert hospitals. This is what's going to happen. This is what to expect. We had people all along the route of the marathon. So it's really a coordination of information and communication.
Before we get back to the calls, I mean, since you were in the middle of this horror on April 15th, how do you feel about Jahar Tsarnaev being on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine?
I think I'm fairly ambivalent. I think that being aware of what's happening with this person, I think in some cases I haven't thought about him in a little bit. So I think it's increasing my wondering what the status of the case is and where he is and the response. I do see that he definitely was made to look a little hip and fit the Rolling Stone image of
a
rock star.
It clearly is.
But honestly, I didn't read the story, so this will drive me to read it and to probably
it's
be better informed.
Yeah, it is worth reading. Let's go to Anne in the car. You're on the phone with Commissioner Bartlett. Go ahead, Anne.
Hi. I was calling about my daughter who dropped in BMI this year she was in the 35th percentile last year when she was 9, and this year at her 10th year visit, she dropped down to 6. And her pediatrician asked me to change over to whole milk and giving her Carnation instant breakfast and an extra snack every day. And then I sort of got worried because I wondered, you know, at what point is that not healthy? You know what I mean? Like, I'm wondering, like, isn't it better to be kind of thin than kind of fat?
Well, you can be also underweight to an extent that isn't healthy, too. So I think that you did the right thing by discussing this with your doctor and getting advice for how to make sure that she has a balanced weight. And sometimes there are cases, I know being a nurse, when someone's malnourished, that getting weight on is better than where the weight comes from.
And thank you for the call. Before I go back to the calls, Commissioner Bartlett, as I said to you, as a kid who was, let's put it euphemistically, a little heavy myself. When you look at the childhood obesity rates, it's just, it is, the only good news in the last week is that Mexico is even fatter than we are. Other than that, it is a mess. There was a dispute when a year or so ago, before your time, when there was a decision made to send the BMI measurements of students home, I think in their backpacks. I'm not sure what the vehicle was. I know the state's now reexamining that because the fear is that information is getting into the wrong hands. It's leading to some bullying. Where does that stand and what's going to happen?
So I've been at the department 5 years. I was the director of the Bureau of Community Health and Prevention. Oh. So I've been actually involved in implementing the BMI regulations. And I think that Massachusetts was one of the most progressive states and took the most comprehensive approach to childhood obesity, and we put our BMI regulations together that included sending a letter to parents.
And how did it get there? We did radio shows, and this was a lot of controversy.
Right.
Was it in the backpack? Was it mailed? How was it done? I can't remember.
The protocol and the best practice is to send it to the parent to inform them what the number is, to suggest that this is a screen that indicates your child might be at risk, and to discuss with your doctor. So it doesn't
So
say,
the kid doesn't have the document.
Mailed.
It's not,
but not all places actually follow the protocol in the same way. So it might get given to the student. Sometimes a parent might give it to the student, and the students bring them to school. Sometimes the way screenings are done in schools is to sort of line kids up and have a screening day. So if you're being weighed in front of all of your
I would have been humiliated peers, if I was a kid and that had been done.
It can be really
challenging
and really...
So what's the revisiting now? What's the deal?
So the governor really asked us because of all the concerns that have been coming forward from all sorts of individuals and officials in towns across the state was to really evaluate whether what in the BMI regulations are effective and what are not. And really looking at it, there was most recently, and anti-obesity work is new, so we're sort of building evidence as we go and we try things, is that California had a study and showed that schools that gave the parental notification by letter as we are, and those that were not had no difference in the impact to the rates of childhood obesity. And so our recommendation has been that if it really doesn't have an impact on the rates and it's distracting us from what does, why don't we recommend removing that? And
so that's what's going to happen?
We've made a proposal to the Public Health Council that we remove the parental notification as a requirement, that it's voluntary. Individual communities, if they're having a good experience with it, may continue. Parents can call the school and ask for it. But that we'll continue to collect the BMI data because the critical part is looking at a population. How is the population doing overall?
Right, but how do you get, if you
are
don't do this,
it?
And I understand the Cal, I didn't know about the California thing until you mentioned, but as a kid who grew up single kid, an only kid for a single mother who thought if I weighed 400 pounds, I was the perfect little boy. I mean, I'm not because she was unkind or cruel, but you know, the perfect, you know, child is. So how do you alert parents who are so blind, in my opinion, not all of them, I know it's a generalization, to the fact that there is a, I think, not just a physical health risk, but a mental health risk to their kid who is dramatically overweight? And I know the data shows if you're an overweight kid, you're much more likely to be an overweight adult. So what do you do now if you're not dealing directly with the parents?
So we are giving information to communities as a whole. We're doing public health campaigns that's getting out there. We have what we consider a signature program at the department called Mass in Motion. We're in 52 communities where we're really...
You were behind that, were you not?
Yes, sir. And we think that getting to communities and having communities identify what the barriers are to healthy living, active living, and healthy eating, and that information will get out in that way. We're really learning in public health that individual one-on-one counseling and education takes us a long time to get the impact we're looking for. So this is really a population health approach.
You know, let me ask you a quick question, Commissioner, because we're getting emails from some people. Kristen was one that was concerned about misinformation about taking ticks out, wants to know where you can get accurate information. It's a million sites. I mean, do you guys have a site that says stuff like this? This is how you get a deer tick out. This is how you find a deer tick. Or if not, are there other places people can go? Because there are a million sites.
Right. I can't say absolutely that I know we tell you how to remove a tick on our site.
Okay. Do you have a site that tells you other things, though?
We do have a site. We have a site if you go on mass.gov and DPH with a mosquito on it, so you can get some of the up-to-date risk analysis of what's going on with mosquitoes.
Okay.
And by the way, if you're a parent with an overweight kid, the site to go to is jimbrowdy.com, and I will give you some personal advice. Let's go to Cindy in Carlisle. You're on with Commissioner Cheryl Bartlett. She's the Commissioner of Public Health in Massachusetts. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I wanted to talk to the commissioner about the diagnostic testing that's used for West Nile virus.
Go right ahead.
I'm a person that has West Nile encephalitis. I'm recovering from it. And I'm home now, finally recovering. But I had been diagnosed by a neurology team at the infectious disease department at a Boston hospital. And they felt very confident after conducting an antibody test that what was causing my encephalitis was West Nile virus. Of course, they had to narrow out lots of other possibilities for that. But at any rate, I understood that the state came in and did a test, a PCR kind of test that looks for live virus replicating in the cerebrospinal fluid, and that test came back negative. So as a result, I wasn't classified as a person who has West Nile. I'm not one of the statistics that the commissioner was talking about earlier. And I'm just wondering how that works, because it seems to me that even if their test was negative and the Boston Hospital test was positive, that there should be some kind of reckoning of those results. Maybe I should be listed as a probable case.
It's a good question. How about it, Commissioner Brown?
Well, we do two-step testing. And first of all, viruses are very challenging to measure. There's many types of viral meningitis. But typically, we do a preliminary testing, and then we do a confirmatory testing. And so I can't say if you did your both testing with the Department of Health. It sounds like you did not. So there are two steps to confirming a particular infection exists.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Let's go to Providence, where Peter's on the phone with Commissioner Cheryl Bartlett. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jim. Love you guys. Love your show.
Thank you.
In 2006, I contracted Lyme disease, and it was the sickest I ever was for 5 to 7 days. As a result, I have something called babesiosis, and the blood centers will not let me donate blood, even though my own personal physician has said I've been tested for babesiosis and actually test negative. And that's a great loss to me because I was a regular blood contributor.
So that's babesiosis, which is not Lyme disease. Maybe you had both Lyme disease and babesiosis, and actually people that get both get quite sick, sicker than getting either one of them alone. And babesiosis is an intracellular parasite that is similar to a malaria infection. So not knowing what exactly your test results said, if you were diagnosed with it, the parasite eventually does go away if treated. And so I am not really sure what the recommendation is once you've been treated, if it's completely eliminated, whether or not giving blood is advisable or not.
Hey, Peter, the only advice I can give you is since you're in Providence, is call the Cheryl Bartlett Equivalence Office in Rhode Island and pursue it. But good luck. And
or a blood
thanks
bank.
For trying to give. That's a great point. Trying to give blood. Peter, thanks for the call.
So, Commissioner Bartlett, what do you do? It's summertime, a lot of mosquitoes out. When you go out at dusk, do you load up with off, or what do you do?
Well, for ticks, you have to be protected all of the time. So we recommend, and this helps with ticks and mosquitoes, to wear long pants, easy to say on a hot day, long sleeve shirts, try to keep your skin protected.
If you're going someplace like woodsy.
If you're going someplace woodsy, for ticks in particular, because they tend to be in tall grassy areas.
Yeah.
So if you're out walking, tucking your pants into your socks, so you really don't have any opportunity for them to get on you. Checking your pets. Pets is another way that ticks get brought into expose humans to Lyme disease.
Now, what about those frontline things that they sell for dogs to prevent ticks and fleas?
I'm not sure what that is, but it might be a Daminex product. Mm-hmm. There are things that you can put around your property if you're going to be out in your yard, Daminex tubes that actually mice will nest in, and it will help to kill the ticks, and it can keep your personal property protected from ticks and reduce the tick population. Again, mosquitoes, don't be out at dusk, staying away from areas where ticks are known, where there's high population of mosquitoes. Again, covering your skin, and insect repellent is a very effective way to
prevent. And what's
the scoop
on DEET now? I knew DEET was a very controversial ingredient in insect repellent.
That is considered to be one of the best ways, repellent that has DEET in it, and it's a certain percentage of DEET that is the higher percentage it is, was what was causing danger. And so products are made with a much lower
chemical product.
Yes.
Okay.
Cheryl Bartlett, before you go, if people, you know, you mentioned the website again. You mentioned, what's the website again for the Public Health Commission?
mass.gov/DPH.
And if people have questions, is there a way to someone email or call about anything that's in the public health ambit? What do they do?
Information about the commissioner's office. It talks about each bureau and all the different works that we do.
If you just have a question about a tick or whatever, who do you call?
You can. There will be different contact information for each of the different areas of work that we do. We have a main number that someone can always refer you to appropriate place. 617-624-5200.
624-5200. Before you go away, quickly, you're a worrier. This is like the worst job ever for a worrier. I'm thinking, as you go down the list of all these nightmares, I'm serious.
Yeah.
Like, what's your blood pressure
about
like?
Dreaming ticks and mosquito bites.
106 over 60 at my last physical, yeah.
That's great.
What are you, in total denial or something?
I do yoga.
You do. Well, there you go.
You don't have nightmares about ticks.
I have nightmares about everything.
Oh, okay.
She's an honest woman. She's the Public Health Commissioner, Cheryl Bartlett. Cheryl, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate
it. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to meet you.
Okay. Up next, Commissioner, by the way, never mind. I'm not going to ask you now. We're running out of time. Okay. What we're talking about next is summer reading with Christopher Lydon. He thinks that summer reading is not the time to read those light little trashy chick lit beach novels, but much different sort of literature. He's going to tell us about that up next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We want to know what you're reading this summer at 877-301-8970. Do you buy into the premise that summer reading should be light reading, you know, 50 Shades of Grey, murder mysteries, or do you take on the big books of our literary canon, the Moby Dicks, Ulysses, the complete works of Shakespeare? We did a little research. This summer, Oprah Winfrey is reading Rockaway by Tara Eisen. Bill Gates is reading The Box, How the Shipping Container Made the World Smaller and the Economy Bigger. That's by Mark Levinson. And now we will find out what Christopher Lydon is reading on Open Mic. Chris, it's great to see you.
I want to find out what Marjorie Egan's reading.
So do I.
That's why I'm here.
She's a real reader. She is a real reader.
Well, I don't read nearly as much as I should because I'm too busy reading periodicals and newspapers. But I am in a book club with women who are much smarter than I am. So I have very little to say at my book club. But we just finished reading Tenderest of Night because of The Great Gatsby just having come out. Everybody read Great Gatsby. So why don't I read Tenderest of Night?
Great idea.
Yeah, lots of people trashed it in my book club. They did not
like
it. Yeah, found it very dated. Needless to say, women are only useful for how good looking they are. That rubs some people the wrong way. And it was extremely depressing. I mean, I read 150 pages last afternoon about to kill myself. But except for that, it was beautifully written.
You know, Chris won't even ask me because he knows I read the lowest. This is going to, I'm humiliated even
to say. You read Portnoy's Complaint.
I read it about 30 times when I was younger. I was Portnoy. But let me tell I read the trashiest, lowest rent murder mysteries, which I know runs afoul of the Lydon School of Summer Reading.
I was that way once. You know, I was just, Remy, you talk about reading Portnoy 30 times. I applied to Portsmouth Priory once as a kid, and you had to list seven books that you read in the previous year. And I searched and searched and searched my soul, and I finally wrote them, and I said, you know, I read one book in the last year, seven times. And it was Joe DiMaggio's Lucky to Be a Yankee. And my father, God rest him, never stopped ragging me about that. But I'm a reformed reader. I am a sort of compulsive reader. But I'm sort of, I think, typical. I want to hear from callers, but an idiosyncratic reader. I read, and Bill Gates and Oprah are classic. I mean, people read everything. My whole theory is that people don't read bestsellers. People read what their mother told them to read or what the book group is reading or their kids are curious about. And it's a raft. It's a salvation from basically the idiocy of most media in which you and I and all of us have spent too much of our lives. No.
See, my thesis,
read a book.
Though,
read Moby read Dick. Talk about Moby Dick.
You know what I did, actually, because I knew not only that you were coming, but I knew what your theme was because Chelsea told us. I actually read the first 20 pages of Moby Dick last night, which I have not read in decades.
Good for you.
In decades. It was on my kids' bookshelf, and it is a total exaltation. I mean, you're so right, but
now,
my mind...
this is the beginning of a new life.
I don't know about that. My mindset, Chris, is, and I mean this sincerely, is summer is the time for mindlessness.
Wrong.
Well, I know you think that. And so that's how I get where I go, and you'll disabuse me.
No, you just answered the question. Read Moby Dick.
Yeah, Moby Dick. You know,
Dostoevsky, read Henry James stories. Read, I got to hear.
Which stories? Short stories?
The novels and the stories. I mean, it always reminds me of Harold Bloom, the great man of Yale who's read everything and remembered everything and memorized everything and can recite everything.
How does he do that?
Well, that's a miracle. But, I mean, he was Google before there was Google. But he did a program with us once on books you should read and whatnot. And a woman called in very earnestly saying how she had come to enjoy cookbooks so much. And so terrific writing, great subject, universal. He said, my dear, you do not have time in this life to read cookbooks. that does not count. This is a gross abuse of your humanity.
You're right.
Read the first 20 pages of Moby Dick, and you'll never go back. I was saying this to my older brother. I presumed to tell him the other night on the phone. He's in the Bay Area. I said, Peter, read the first 30 pages of Proust, and you'll never stop.
Remembrance.
I mean, 30 pages of that boy in his bed waiting for his mother to come up and kiss him goodnight. I mean, long before the Madeleine, it's the most enchanting reading. We've all been there. It's just the introduction to, 3,000 pages of just sort of pulling apart your consciousness and verifying it.
What are you reading this summer? Before we get to calls at 877-301-8971, what are you reading? And two, do you subscribe to the Chris Lydon School of summer reading? What are you reading this summer?
Can I tell you one? First, one little name dropping sort of joke.
Sure.
Oh,
but
love that.
We had this. This is sort of cliche. I think it originally started with Ezra Pound saying, "If all the literature we had was Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, we'd have enough." And he also said, "If all the music we had was Bach, we'd have enough." I always say, "If all the people we had were Indians from India, we'd have enough for the planet for all time, et cetera, et cetera." Anyway, I'm talking with Norman Mailer, and I just mentioned this whole notion of, the Iliad is everything, men, women, love, life, death, war, peace, blah, blah, blah. And he looked burned. He looked stunned. And he sort of came back. He said, Chris, no Proust? No Proust? The fascinating thing to me was that he didn't say no Shakespeare or no Dante, or much less no me. He said, no Proust? Once you have read 30 pages, you will have that feeling. You've entered the most...
And what? Remembrance of Things Past? That's what
whole thing.
The whole thing.
So 3,000, six or eight novels put together, but it's all the consciousness of Marcel, the young writer, and his discovery at 3,000 pages. Yes, he is a writer, and he knows everything. He's considered everything about, especially about family and jealousy and sexuality and art and painting and great writing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So what are you reading?
What are you reading? I just finished reading a book that everybody will read, I'm sure, Paul Harding's sequel to Tinkers. It's called Enon, Nun spelled backward. It's the name of a town in the heart of Essex County, Massachusetts. And it continues the family saga of the Crosbys. This is Charlie Crosby, grandson of the peddler, tinker, clockmaker, et cetera. But it's a story of a man who loses his daughter, in an accident. She's 13, his only child, and what happens to him. And, everybody knows Tinkers, right? I mean, the book that's at the side of every cash register in every bookstore
no,
in America.
No, I don't.
It actually is.
Oh, I don't.
Oh, Brookline Booksmith.
Oh, you must read it.
There I
don't. A couple of days
it's there
ago. Yes, it
everywhere.
Is.
And it's a story of kind of 1900, turn-of-the-century peddler in the backwoods of Maine and New England. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it's just an endless bestseller. And it's, Paul Harding he's our new bard. He's the great young writer of New England and enormously successful. And this book will be, it's very serious work out of the New England tradition of Hawthorne and Melville and Emerson and Thoreau for sure. And it's a very profound reflection on the pain of a man who adored this child and what what the loss does to him. It's a miserable year of addiction and alcohol and loss and vagrancy, and yet it comes to an end. Anyway, that's one that I...
By the way, you should feel very good about yourself. When Marjorie Egan takes notes when a guest is on the show, that is the sign of approval. She's writing furiously.
You must read Tinkers. I mean, this came to me from a friend of my youngest daughter who had been in a creative writing class with Paul Harding, said, Chris, you must read this book.
And okay.
I'm happy to say
I've written it down.
I read it and interviewed him. You can check him out on Radio Open Source. He's an ex-rock drummer, of course, Paul Harding.
Of course.
And he worships... I mean, the first thing Paul Harding said to me when we met was, you know, I've seen you before. And it was listening to Elvin Jones, the drummer, who was his... God, he writes in drummer sort of jazz rhythm. He's an extraordinary person. You must read that.
Let's take a few calls before you get to your next book on your list. Let's go to Peter in Ashland. You're on with Christopher Lydon on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Peter.
How goes it? So I just want to say I personally am a nonfiction guy and specifically a lot of science because I like to know about the world and all that.
Me
but,
too, Peter.
One person that I would definitely strongly recommend reading is... Oliver Sacks, he actually just turned, I think, 80 this year.
Amen.
But, I mean, he's got a way with words regarding stuff from neurology and neuroscience to, as base as chemistry. And
Peter, he's got one of the great...
For neurology.
He's got one of the great titles of all time, correct?
Yeah.
What is it?
Yeah, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Yeah.
I've read.
Peter,
can I just...
Really,
yeah.
And I just want to say, I was going to mention a book that is very much in the Oliver Sacks tradition, completely fascinating and beautiful book by a guy named Gerald Shea, Salem-born guy, but it's called Song Without Words, and it's about his own deafness, realizing at age 34 that he was majorly deaf in both ears, that he was hearing garble.
Yeah, and the differences in people's... reactions to reality that if you're not actually having an outside sight on the difference between people, it's incredible. If you actually check out The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, you'll get a really solid understanding of what can happen when the slightest little misfirings can
Oliver Sacks wrote an article in The New Yorker, I'm sure it was in a book eventually, but about a man who became blind as a child and lived many, many years. He lived in Oklahoma. He was a massage therapist, I think, but he was blind. And then roughly at age 50, he was re-diagnosed, and they figured out a way to restore his sight. And they did, and he couldn't deal with it. It was a classic sort of...
He ended up killing himself, didn't he?
Well, not exactly, but he was deeply depressed and withdrawn, and maybe it was a sort of a false, a false hope that was given to him. But again, it was one of these stories of the intense emotional and psychological ramifications of medicine, physical diagnosis, physical injury. But in the case of Gerry Shea in the book Song Without Words, to me, the completely riveting thing, here's a guy who went to Andover, Yale, and Columbia Law School and couldn't hear anything that people were saying and faked it, became a great lip reader, and he had this garble of noise in his ears that he could eventually sort of decode. But at age 34, he was taking a required ear exam from the Mobile Oil Corporation. And the woman said, you only heard 5 pings out of the last 20. You want to try it with your hearing aids on? He said, when he had to decode what she was saying, but he said, I don't have hearing aids. She said, you're severely deaf. And she knew exactly why. And he waited a year before doing anything about it. And the whole mystery really, and this is sort of in the Oliver Sacks mode, Peter, is he had come to love the song without the words. He almost preferred a completely private world in which he heard what he wanted to hear. He heard a kind of poetic, you know, musical version of what everybody else was thinking, and he loved it. And he was an enormously successful lawyer. I mean, that really took us into an interesting discussion on my website today, I'm happy to say, about sort of afflictions that we adopt, that we cling to, notions of ourselves. No, I'm deaf. I have my own world. Or I don't want to rejoin that other world.
Tell people the website, Chris Lydon.
RadioOpenSource.org.
Of course, Gail, you're in Wellesley. You're on with Christopher Lydon. We're talking about summer reading. Hi, Gail.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Gail.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I agree with Marjorie. I went Fitzgerald mad when I saw the Baz Luhrmann movie.
Yeah.
Because why? The hats. I keep telling all my women friends, ignore the plot, ignore the insane Busby Berkeley overkill, forget the Baz Luhrmann. He hasn't done anything good since the one about professional dancing in Australia. However, I have never seen hats like that.
You're right.
I had my hair bobbed, and I am now the owner of five cloches, which I have decorated in different ways. Insane.
Hey, Gail, Gail, before you continue, did you go to see the hat exhibit at the Peabody Essex Museum?
Not yet.
I don't know if it's still there.
The hat store in JP. I mean, I'm into it.
Yeah, however, the awards of reading.
But
I'm not sure that Harold would pass the Harold Bloom test, Gail, but I want to see your hats.
Go ahead, Gail.
And you in your hats.
They're really cool. And not as cool as the ones on the characters in the movie, though. Anyway, I also know someone who bought the pink suit.
Wow. So what's your book deal, Gail?
I have friends who have gone Gatsby crazed. There's no doubt. Don't know anybody with the car yet, but...
So what's your book deal?
The book deal is that I then started reading by way back to things I remember reading as a kid. I read The Diamond as Big as the Ritz, and I thought... Man is nuts. He writes beautifully, but this is a crazy story that doesn't hang together, and it's got the same theme. You can't get what you want. You know, don't be dazzled by riches. They're deadly. Then I read This Side of Paradise, and I said, all he's got is his autobiography, and boy, is this depressing. And then I went on to Tender is the Night, Marjorie.
Yeah, depressing.
The same thing. All he's got is his autobiography. One of the most depressing books I have ever read.
Yeah. Well, it is about Zelda, his wife, who had a lot of mental health issues in and out of institutions. But I thought, Mr. Book Reader over there, that Tender as the Night was based on Gerald and Sarah Murphy, that glamorous couple of the 1920s. And then Fitzgerald inserted his wife, Zelda, as the wife, but about living with all that great money in the Riviera and stuff like that.
Tender as the Night it goes on my weekend list. Starting right now, I told you I went back into Hemingway last winter, and I didn't. I read
he gets to the
Gatsby
point.
Again.
Gets to the point.
Which one?
Hemingway gets to the point.
Oh yeah, but I Tender Tonight has been, you know.
You'll be disappointed.
I'll bet you I won't. Okay. I bet you I won't. Can I mention one other book that I'm reading around this 4th of July, which I think is really interesting as the U.S. sort of begins to get out of Afghanistan. It's a memoir by a young Afghan, quite unlike any of the other books I've read about Afghanistan. It's called The Fort of Nine Towers by a young guy who just migrated from the Brandeis Business School to the novel writing program at Boston University. His name is Qais Akbar Omar.
It's on Oprah's list, by the way, Chris Lydon.
Is it really?
Chelsea just told me in my ear, yes.
No kidding. Well, it's good for Oprah.
Well, good for both
It's
of
on
them.
My website, too. He's an amazing guy, and I've come to know him quite well. He's a rug dealer. He's a young guy, probably 30. And in effect, he's giving you Afghanistan as if it were a normal country. Tormented by war, it went nuts in the whole sort of Taliban period. And yet he gives you kind of the roots of, in his own family, especially his grandfather, but his father and his brothers and sisters and their adventures. He gives you a sort of taste of what a normal Afghanistan might be, maybe even sooner than later. And in it somehow, rug making, knot tying, becomes a metaphor of sort of slow pattern making, slow progress, the way history actually unfolds. And it's full of most extraordinary torture, even inflicted on him, wild dogs sent to him. He spent days in this kind of cave of full of dead bodies with his grandfather. I mean, the whole thing is beyond sickening. And at the same time, there's something very constructive and forward about the grit with which he came through it. It's a wonderful book, and three cheers for Oprah's endorsement, too.
You know, how about on War Books, Yellow Birds, Kevin Powers' book about Iraq? I thought that was wonderful in terms of getting across the horror of war, and also Generation Kill, which these are not uplifting July books, are they? But I thought Yellow Birds was beautiful.
I admired the Yellow Birds, too.
I did, too.
Although I also thought, you know, even there's such a, of course, and it starts with the Iliad, but war porn. I mean, this kind of glory in the absurd misery of war. You know, William James had, to me, a great insight about war books and such things. I talked about this with Ken Burns on his series about war, I mean, World War II. Even talking about it, it encourages the bastards and encourages the fever and the idiocy. That's what William James said, was that you can't... talking about the horror of war does no good, because it's the horror that drives us, that charms us, that lures us. This is why people have never, you know, turned down a war tax, or, you know, it's a bucket of blood, and there's something evil in us that loves it. That was my reaction to Kevin Powers' book.
Hey, Chris Lydon, let's assume someone is listening and saying, I want to grow up to be a Chris Lydon, Marjorie Egan kind of reader, but I am a Jim Browdy kind of summer reader. What's the transitional book that gets them and me from low-rent murder mystery crap, which I love, to the world where you think we should be spending our summers?
I'm not recommending anything.
Oh, come on, Chris Lydon.
No. Okay, but taking your question earnestly, I mean, I started with Ring Lardner. That was my first fiction, and it was, you know, it was a transition out of baseball, you know me, Al, and those wonderful stories into Hemingway and others. I also came from a family. I was the slow reader, the bad reader in a family of six incredibly charged readers.
I was a slow reader in the family of one, I should say. Oh, so wow. I was a variation.
No,
on the
my
theme.
Brother Michael was set an incredible pace of. I mean, he as a kid, 10, 12 years old, maybe older, but he got into James T. Farrell and sort of American realism, Theodore Dreiser and stuff. And he's still way, way down the road ahead of me. But I would say, do what you did with Moby Dick. Somebody said, you know, there's a novelist named Bob Shakoches who has a big book that's heavily touted for the fall, and I'm just beginning it. It's called The Woman Who Lost Her Soul. It's sort of his epic reporting about sort of how this world went nuts in the sort of pre-9/11 period. But anyway, somebody said to me, it's the new Moby Dick. And I said, no, Moby Dick is the new Moby Dick. Start with Moby Dick and try to figure it out. I mean, on your third reading, what's going on here? Moby Dick can be presented. We did a radio program in the Bush years, George Bush years, about Moby Dick as a kind of anticipation of George Bush, the war in Iraq. You know, the captain is mad. The crew can't stop him. Colin Powell was Starbuck, who couldn't say, you know, you're nuts and I'm firing you. I'm taking you out, et cetera, et cetera. There's a new, you know, Chris Hedges was writing the other day that Moby Dick is the book of this time, of a kind of culture gone mad, empire gone mad. Who's going to stop it? Where's the intelligentsia? Where's the middle class, meaning the white officer class? And where's the heroic crew? I mean, the multinational crew of the Pequod is to me the most fascinating part of it. Queequeg is the best of them, the great harpooner who commands such authority with his skill, his manhood, his courage, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. We got Moby Dick. We're up against the clock, but I want to say one girl
book.
That's
the answer, Moby Dick.
But if you're a woman out there and you haven't read it, and probably most everybody has because it's on the top of all these lists, one of my favorite books of all time is To the Lighthouse. You may not like it that much because it's more of a girl book.
And
Mrs. Dalloway, Virginia Woolf, is my all heroine.
Oh,
and she's absolutely wonderful.
Marjorie, you keep
Mrs. Ramsey.
Growing in my...
I want to be Mrs. Ramsey.
What do you mean she keeps growing
Mrs. Ramsey.
In your estimation? Where was she prior to the growth?
I was a little tabloid girl before.
No, Marjorie.
And you know what else? It's a wonderful book, even though everybody trashes it now because of the subject matter. But Lolita. slowly too.
Oh,
you gave me that book about 15 years ago. Do you remember that?
Yes. Okay.
Hey, Chris Lydon, thank you.
We have a gentleman.
Read the best. Harold Bloom would say, "Read the best, and just keep reading it. Don't read the junk."
Chris Lydon, great to see you. Thanks so much.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much, Christopher Lydon. We have Adam Riley, who's hanging outside the courthouse down at the Whitey Bulger trial. Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy testified in court today, and we have the death, unexpectedly, of one of the witnesses in that trial. Stay tuned for the latest from the Moakley Courthouse, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Two huge developments in the Bulger case today. His longtime partner, Stephen Flemmy, takes the stand, and his longtime adversary, a man who says Bulger extorted his liquor store away from him in the 80s, is found dead. As you know from us, there are no cameras in the courtroom. We've got the second best thing. Here's our resident Bulger watcher live from the Moakley Courthouse, GBH's Adam Riley. Hey there, Adam.
Hey, guys. How goes it?
Great.
Hey, thank you, Adam. Well, before we get to what happened in court today, you know, we have all learned, as Jim just mentioned, that Stephen Rakes, who was supposed to have been a key witness, apparently was dropped from the witness list, but he's supposed to have been a key witness, was found dead this morning on Mill Road in Lincoln, on a side of the road, apparently. And for people that don't know, he was supposed to testify that Bulger and Stephen Flemmy threatened his young child at gunpoint and forced him to turn over his South Boston a liquor store because Whitey and Flemmy wanted to buy it and turn it into their own liquor store. And, of course, what happened was they did take over this liquor store. Kevin Meeks, of course, said last week that that wasn't so, that that it wasn't true that Bulger's gang put a gun, put the muzzle of a gun inside his little toddler's daughter's mouth and threatened him. But in any case, this is so bizarre. I mean, was this talked about today and what happened to poor Stephen Rakes?
It is. There was a lot of sort of quiet buzz around it among the media in the courtroom. It was almost, I think, getting more attention than the trial itself, at least until Steve Flemmy took the stand. Then that changed. But, yeah, you know, the coincidence, and that's all it is right now as far as we know, but coincidence of Steve Rakes' suicide and what's been happening at this trial, I mean, it's really, you know, I say it's all only a coincidence at this point, but it has to be more, right? I mean, or you would think it would have to be more. He was really upset after Kevin Weeks testified. I think it was it just last week?
Yes,
it was.
When Weeks testified, and as you said, Marjorie, challenged this kind of classic account, which is at the heart of Black Mass, among other tales of Bulger's reign. This, you know, horrific tale in which Bulger and Flemmy are in the liquor store, and Weeks, and they allow, as you said, Steve Rakes' his toddler daughter to put the barrel of a gun into her mouth. I mean, it's one of the most chilling details. There's a ton of chilling details attached to everything Bulger did over the years, but that's one of the worst. And you could tell after Weeks challenged that account, as he told it when he was on the stand, you know, the child reached for the gun at one point and Bulger shoved it to the other side of the table and said, "Put that away." You know, much less dramatic, almost made Bulger sound in a situation of extortion like he was protecting the child. After court that day, I remember watching Stephen Rakes talk about what he'd heard, and it was clear that he was very upset, but we were trying to get him to, you know, talk about specifics of his account compared to Weeks' account, trying to get him to talk in detail about what Weeks had gotten wrong, and he wouldn't do that. He just said something like, you know, that guy's dumb, or I don't remember what word he used, but that guy's no good. He's had his day on the stand, and I'll have my day later on to say what really happened. Hey, and it was after that he, as I understood it, was told by the prosecution that they probably weren't going to charge him. And from a, you know, from a tactical point of view on the prosecution's part, you can see why in a way, because if you're a prosecution witness, and, well, tell me if I'm right about this, Jim, because I'm you know, a layperson. I talk about this stuff. You're the attorney.
Sort of, yeah. Go ahead.
It seems to me, right, he once were an attorney.
I was.
it seems to me like if you have an attorney like Weeks who presents one account of this seminal moment in the Bulger saga, and then you have another government attorney called in Stephen Ray, who tackles the same moment, the same, you know, pivotal moment in the Bulger saga, and offers an account that is fundamentally different than what the government's first star witness presented, it just seems to me like it would raise questions or could raise questions in the minds of the jury about, all right, who are we supposed to believe? The government can't even get its key witnesses on the same page.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good point.
Really trust? And I may be wrong about that.
Adam, let me just say right now, you would have been a far better lawyer than I was, because it never occurred to me,
yeah,
but I think that point is dead on.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that.
We don't know, obviously, what happened with Stephen Rakes, but it's possible he could have been so devastated by not, after all these decades, having his opportunity to get his day in court.
Yeah, that is a possibility. I mean, it's always dicey. You know, whenever you end up, if someone takes their own life, it's, of course, incredibly tempting to speculate about their motives. And, you know, we all do it. I've done it, you know, more times than I can remember. But who knows what really happened? We don't know what his immediate...
Has this been confirmed? By the way, Adam, has this been confirmed as a suicide, or they don't know?
I'm really glad you stopped me on that. That's the first report I heard, and the subsequent accounts that I've read have suggested that's the case, but you're right. We do not know.
Okay, so let's leave it there. Tell us what actually happened today on a day that court watchers have been waiting for forever.
Yeah, well, at first it was a little anticlimactic because we had this guy, William David Lindholm, this big-time marijuana dealer who had been extorted, shaken down by Bulger and his associates, allegedly for $250,000. They wanted $1 million, but Lindholm said he talked to them at $250,000. He took the stand this morning early on for the defense's cross-examination, and a lot of people in the media started thinking pretty early on that Jay Carney, Bulger's attorney, was basically trying to run out the clock with his cross-examination of this guy. I actually didn't buy that theory initially because Lindholm was a very compromised, very shaky witness. I thought Carney was spending a lot of time with him to show how unreliable, once again, a key government witness was. But the longer it went on, the longer you really did get the strong sense that Carney was just trying to delay the moment at which Fleming took the stand. And, you know, there were other moments in this trial, or have been other moments in this trial, like, for example, the threat to call Kevin Cullen and Shelley Murphy and Howie Carr and Dick Lehr and Jerry O'Neill as witnesses, which would keep them from reporting on the trial. That was another moment where you had the impression that maybe Bulger's defense team was just doing something on behalf of their client out of spite. And it kind of felt that way as Lindholm's testimony dragged on. I found myself wondering if maybe Bulger just wanted to piss off his old associate by keeping him waiting in the holding room, you know, just kind of annoy him, needle him by keeping him from taking the stand. There was a very strange moment at one point in Lindholm's cross where the government had, we had taken a break, and we thought we were going to be getting Fleming when we came back in. And in fact, Fleming was led into the courtroom and just kind of stood there near the witness stand for a few minutes. And it almost seemed like people didn't really know what was going on, like the government had made a mistake in having him brought in. He apparently was trading some pointed looks with Bulger at this time. But when I saw him, he just looked like he's 79 years old. He was wearing a windbreaker that almost looked like a members-only windbreaker. And honestly, he just looked like an older guy who should be strolling on Revere Beach. And I did not even realize who he was at first because he looked so unlike the old shots that we're used to seeing of this barrel-chested, really threatening figure. Then somehow the government finally realized they had maybe screwed up, took him out, brought Lindholm back in. The Lindholm cross went on again for an excruciatingly long time. And then finally, near the end, with maybe 15 or 20 minutes left in the day, Fleming was brought in, took the stand, and you know, we got the beginning of his testimony against his old partner in crime.
And was there any content that was dramatic, or was it just the setup for the... I mean, obviously, the major difference, and I'm not the first to have said this obvious thing, is unlike Martorano and Weeks, who a juror could say, well, I don't know if I'm going to believe them in toto, in light of the fact they both got unbelievable deals, 12 years and 5 years respectively, for having done some pretty heinous things. This guy didn't get much of a break. His break is he wasn't put to death by the state.
That's it.
Instead, he has to spend his whole life there. So arguably, his credibility will be least in question, one would think, by a jury.
I think that's a great point. I mean, getting the death penalty off the table is, you know, it's no small thing. He pled guilty to 10 murders. Who knows how many murders he actually committed. But, yeah, I think he does have extra credibility because he didn't get one of these deals that, you know, leave you wondering why the world works the way it does. Let me tell you some of the highlights from the meeting, or pardon me, from his testimony. He was asked to describe Bulger's personality by Fred Wyshak, the prosecutor. He said, overbearing, forceful. All this time, he and Bulger are locked in this sort of staring match to end all staring matches. You know, two guys trying to stare each other down. It's clear from, you know, just the way they make eye contact that they loathe each other. Wyshak went in and asked, more overbearing and forceful than you? And Fleming, a man of few words, said, yes. Then near the end, actually, right when his testimony was done for the day, let me back up just very, very briefly.
Yeah, we only have a minute, Adam, if you can.
One minute left. Okay, he described his relationship with Bulger as strictly criminal, but then went on to say that, in fact, they were friends. They took vacations together, even. He said that Bulger was an FBI informant, met with the FBI hundreds of times, as he put it, and did most of the talking in these meetings where he and Fleming would meet with the FBI. But then the highlight, if you can call it that, came at the end, where when court wrapped for the day, there was a profane exchange of some sort between Fleming and Bulger. Again, they're staring at each other, each one sort of refusing to look away and look weak. We didn't hear it all from the media section, but what we did catch was Fleming saying what sounded like mother bleeper to Bulger, Bulger coming back with something that wasn't audible, and then Fleming saying, really? And he said when he dropped the MF bomb and then said, really, he's muttering in this incredibly dark tone of voice. It was actually, I mean, it was kind of chilling and terrifying because you know what these guys are capable of. And as we've seen in a few other moments in the trial, you know that if circumstances were different, if each of these guys, say, had a gun in their hand, that we would have seen a less peaceful resolution.
A shootout.
Well, you know, the most amazing thing, Adam, we've got to go, and we'll talk more to you tomorrow, is when you describe the scene of the 79-year-old in The Windbreaker, when you see these two old men, one octogenarian, one almost octogenarian, and you envision who they were as compared to who they look like, it's staggering. Adam, as always, Adam Riley, thank you so much for your time. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Thanks.
Adam Riley was, of course, reporting from the Moakley Courthouse, the Whitey Bulger trial. Okay, so when it comes to people who make it to the coroner office, we're conditioned to think ambition, focus, and drive is what gets them there. But one man says not so, and he's changing the way people think about work, success, and happiness on the job. Karen Miller brings us that conversation up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Adam Grant is the youngest tenured professor at Penn's Wharton School, a school where I was enrolled for one day, by the way.
One day.
It's all I lasted. He's the world's expert on a number of things, including how to make workers productive. He rejects the academic orthodoxy and concludes it's better to give than to receive. Here to explain what I said, much more importantly, what Adam Grant says, is Karen Miller, she of the Innovation Hub. Hey, Karen Miller.
Hey, good to be here. So, you know, it's interesting because I was a real skeptic of this going in. You think about Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, when they were climbing up the ladder. These are not nice guys, really.
Not at all.
But Adam Grant has this theory that is borne out again and again in research, that it is really the nice guys who finish first. The people who give back to other people, not the people who step on other people on their way to the top. And, you know, we're talking people who get to the corner office, people who make a ton of money, people who are really successful. We're not just talking about, you know, the people who seem like, you know, your nice neighbor, that kind of thing. I mean, we're really talking about people who themselves profit.
But hey, let me be clear about this before we encourage calls. Let me do it now at 877-301-8970. My understanding is part of his thesis is what makes workers most productive is not what people like me thought did it, which is financial incentive, chance of career advancement. But he says something like it's the opportunity to serve others. Is that not his
thing?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So there's a ton of research looking at, so you're a doctor and you're a nurse and you have a sign in front of you and it says, if you wash your hands right now, you are going to help yourself prevent disease, right? They test that against doctors and nurses who see a sign that says, if you wash your hands now, you will help patients prevent disease. And the patient's one gets lots more doctors and nurses to wash their hands. Now, you might not think that. You might think, well, you would care about yourself right. a lot more than you care about somebody you don't even know. But in fact, when people are being altruistic, they often do the very, very best stuff.
Well, this guy, now, he's a big superstar. He's 31 years old, big star at Wharton, publishes like crazy, teaches like crazy. And then he helps all these students.
Right.
Anecdotes about the kids lined up outside his doorway, and he's writing them elaborate recommendation letters, and he's giving them advice in their careers. He's helping them nonstop. But you think to yourself, how does this guy, now, besides the fact he's got a wife that stays at home and takes care of the kids in the house and cooks all the dinners and probably does all the laundry too.
That helps.
But it does help. It helps enormously. But how does he have time to do all this? And I think a lot of us feel like, you know, we'd love to mentor more. We'd like to help people more. But you don't have time to get your work done and do all this mentoring. How does he do it?
I know. Well, he is a super nice guy. He tackles like 200 emails a day. He's in his early 30s, as you said.
Yeah.
He got his PhD in 3 years. I think part of it is compartmentalizing your day mm-hmm. and compartmentalizing even your week. So saying, you know, today I'm not going to write any emails. I'm just going to do things that help me, career advancement, sort of deep thinking. But and then now, these few hours, I'm just going to help other people. I think what many of us do is everything gets mixed together and we spend so much time sort of toggling back and forth between one activity and another, which actually the human brain is very, very bad at doing.
Yeah.
That we spend a lot of time in the transition mode rather than really, really doing one thing or another thing.
Let me test his thesis in the most simplified fashion. 877-301-8970. For you listening right now, is it financial inducements or the possibility of career advancement, which is what I always thought it was, that gets you to be most productive in whatever your work is, or is it the opportunity to be of service to others? I mean, I have always thought totally unscientifically. That's the ancillary benefit. It's great to do something where you help other people. It makes you feel good. I mean, there's no question it does. But it seems to me, having done none of the research, that money, benefits, rising up the chain is so central to what drives people, but he rejects that completely, doesn't he?
So he looked at Fortune magazine, the 640 most influential people. So you're talking Michael Dell and you're talking Bill Gates. And they did, you know how everybody has like a LinkedIn profile now, right?
Yep.
So they looked at who in the country is the most connected to these 640 people. There's a guy named Adam Rifkin. Ever heard of him?
No.
Is this a made-up thing or
is this
a real thing?
No, it's a real thing.
Okay,
this guy is Adam Rifkin. So the question is, how did he get so connected? Adam Rifkin, very rich guy, and he is a huge, what Adam Grant calls a giver. Like, he does things for other people all the time. How did he get to be so connected to the other people? The first thing he did was he did a favor for this guy. So in the early 90s, the internet starting out, people don't really know it that well. Adam Rifkin likes this really, really small band that people didn't know that well. It was called Green Day. So he's working on a fan page for Green Day. And this guy, this college student, calls him up and is like, well, you know, this is a great page, but you have tagged them as punk rock. And clearly, I'm a punk rock fan, this guy says, this college student. They are not punk rock. Adam Rifkin's like, okay, fine. I really don't know what punk rock even means, but I'll look into it and I'll take that off if it's necessary. And the guy says, the college student says, you know what? It would be great if you could help us make some punk rock fan pages so that if people accidentally landed on Green Day, they could really be redirected to something that's really punk rock. So Adam Rifkin's like, fine, okay. And so he does it. He does this favor for this guy. This college student doesn't know him. A few years later, Adam Rifkin calls up this college student, Graham Spencer, who's no longer in college, of course. And, you know, Adam Rifkin has just moved to Silicon Valley. He needs some help. Graham Spencer has just sold a little company called Excite, which you might remember, for $6.7 billion. So he sets him up. And that, I mean, at the time that Adam Rifkin did that favor, he had no idea what this person was going to become. But that is basically the story of Adam Rifkin's life, doing favors for people knowing when those people were going to come back into his life.
Well, he talks about in this piece the givers, the matchers, and the takers.
Right.
So what's the difference?
So a giver is somebody like Adam Rifkin, where you give something and you have no sense that you're ever going to get anything back. Right. So he did this favor for Graham Spencer, Punk Rock Pages. It was just wasted time in some sense.
Can we bring it down to a level lower than them?
Yeah.
There was a great story out of some Boston suburb the other day where somebody went to a drive-thru. I don't know if it was Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's. They said, I want to pay for the coffee for the person behind me.
Yeah.
Did you hear what happened in the story?
No.
55 customers in a row. 55 customers in a row paid for the person in back of them because it was done for them, which is a variation on theme. Okay, so those are the givers. What's the next group?
Okay, so then you've got the matchers. So there are people who I say, you know, Marjorie, I'll do something for you, but I'd really like you to do something for me. Could you help me out with this?
Right.
So it's kind of – a lot of people are like that.
I think a lot of people are like that.
Right. So – and it could also be time delayed. So maybe you did something for me. So you kind of feel like I owe you. I kind of feel like I owe you. And at some point, I'll make it up to you by doing something for you. And takers – I think we all have met takers.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Who will just, you know – Right, exactly. They'll email you. You'll spend a ton of time helping them and, like, see you later. They're never – or you'll be like, oh, I'll pick up their tab on whatever. Yep. And you think, like, next time they might help you out, it will never happen.
Now, there's another angle to this, too, which I think is very fascinating. You talk about these kids that were working in this fundraising call center.
Yeah.
And they weren't really into the job, but something changed dramatically. This is the one I related to. Myself, because you know, oftentimes if you're tired, I noticed writing a column about someone, if you're tired or you're rushed and you think, but you just interviewed this person and this person deserves my full attention because they gave me a half hour's time on the phone. I find that that is what will motivate me when I'm like tired. It was very analogous to what happened in the fundraising center. So explain that story.
So one of the very first things Adam Grant did that he sort of got famous for was that he revolutionized call centers. I personally hate getting those calls from a college, grad school. They call you almost inevitably while you're cooking dinner and say, like, can you help us out and give us $50 or whatever. And it turned out that almost everybody turned these people down. You know, that somebody will say, I'm a sophomore at something, which is, you know, you feel bad, but, you know, whatever. And Adam Grant realized that if you bring in somebody who has gotten help, like, who had really gotten a scholarship from the college or whatever, sat them down, not with the person being called, but with the people doing the calling, immediately they do tons better. Because they're not reading from a script anymore. It's like what Marjorie is saying. They have in mind, like, wow, the stuff I'm doing matters. It helps real people. It's not just something I'm doing over and over and over again. So he really tries to tie things in and make these kinds of human connections. And it's amazing how well it works. I have a couple of experiments to tell you, but... You know.
I'm stunned. 877, I really am. It's 877-301-8970. Is this your experience as a worker, wherever you are, or as an independent person? Is it the financial reward on one hand, which I, you know, it seems to me, or is it this notion that you can do something good for others? It seems to me that if you have the first, that if you have the first, you're doing well enough or you've gotten some financial reward, then you're much more open to doing the second. But it seems that what Adam Grant is saying is if you had to choose, which I know is arbitrary, but as an employer, for example, if you had to choose between offering that opportunity to be of service to your fellow man or woman and feel good about that, as opposed to trying to scrape up some extra money to make the financial life of an employee better, he seems to be saying the former is going to be a greater motivator to productivity for that worker than the latter. Is that not what he's saying?
Yeah, and it ends
up... You buy
up
that?
I do.
You know,
I do.
I mean, I'm still torn. I know the research, but I still wonder if people really look around them at their workplaces and think, yeah, this person is so generous and nice and they have totally gotten ahead versus this person who's sort of mean and selfish and they've gotten ahead. Now,
it's but mean and selfish is not, I mean, that's taken an extreme.
Or,
I don't consider it mean and selfish to say I'd like to be compensated at a greater level.
That's true.
That will cause me to be more excited about my work.
That's
right?
Absolutely. No, I think think that's absolutely true. There's an issue of fairness, right? There's an issue of what people deserve. And then there's an issue of basically saying, oh, well, that wasn't your work, Jim. That was my, you know, like stealing other people's stuff and passing it off as your, it's taking rather than giving.
But I think also he taps into this whole thing with, you want to feel as though you're doing something that matters. You're not just making widgets. Well, I guess widgets matter. What are widgets anyway? I have no idea. But, you know, that you're doing something that matters and is worthwhile, as opposed to something that's just sort of...
As a primary motivator, I'm not quarreling with either you or surely what little 12-year-old Adam Grant says. He's 31, I think, or 32. What I'm saying is, as an addendum to a well-compensated career path kind of career, that's wonderfully satisfying.
Look at teachers. Teachers do something wonderful, good teachers, for all these kids, and they're not making big bucks.
Yeah, but, you know, haven't you heard, I think all of us working in media have heard people say, oh, this person, this anchor on the news, this guy is really nice. Now, I've also heard people say, well, this person's a jerk.
Yeah.
But haven't you heard people saying, like, this person is unbelievably nice, and you think, wow, how did the person get to the top of, like, a major network, and they're unbelievably nice? But I've heard that about multiple people. So, I mean, I think they're...
This works for the Pope, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I want to be clear here. I'm not suggesting that there is a malevolent strain in human beings and people don't care about other people. But self-concern, for lack of a better expression, it seems is both a decent thing and a decent motivator. Let's go to Jennifer in Worcester. You're on with Kara Miller, and we're talking about productivity in a grand sort of way. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I just wanted to share a little story with you.
Please.
I was working at a company, you know, where I was very well compensated for the work that I was doing, got stock options, got everything like that. But it was such a horrible environment. Like, nobody appreciated anybody. Nobody said, you know, hey, you're doing a great job. You know, simple little things like that. I took a huge pay cut, working a little closer to home, and it's so much of a better place to work at, just because, you know, little things. My boss will tell me, you know, hey, you did a great job on doing that.
Really?
Yeah. That's fascinating. That's fascinating. And
is that other job still open, Jennifer, or not?
It is still open, but honestly, I would not recommend it.
But is it the sort of work, though? I mean, did you feel as though you were doing something that mattered and was a good thing at the first job that you left and hated?
It's not the first job that I hated. It was something that, you know, I was, you know, really contributing to the company, and, you know, the position that I was in, like, we made the money for the company.
Yeah.
But there was so little recognition for it.
Okay.
Well, it's a variation of the theme. Jennifer, thank you so much for the call.
And it ties into stuff Michael Norton has talked about with both of us, about this idea of, you know, you get to a threshold where you have enough to eat and you have a place to sleep. And then after that, happiness is not really the difference between $100,000 and $120,000, because it's hard all the time to keep that in your mind, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, your happiness is liking the people. I mean, if you have to sit next to every day somebody you hate, I mean, that is there all the time. And I have to come back to something Jennifer said. There is a great study. So, and this turns out to be true with almost everybody. So you sit at a table with this guy who's given 10 $1 bills. So he's got 10 bucks, you've got nothing, right? Mm-hmm. And he turns to you and says, okay, well, I just got this $10. I'm going to split it up with you. I get 8 and you get 2. Almost everybody will say, no, no way. And they know that by saying no way, nobody gets anything. But they think it is so unfair. They don't like that he's a taker. They would rather have nothing than $2, which, you think, if you think about it, it's illogical. They came in with no money. $2 is better than no money, but they want to punish the person. They don't like it being inequitable. I mean, it goes back to the Dunkin' Donuts story, right? People like people who are givers.
I agree. Megan, you're in Salem. You're on with Kara Miller, and you know what we're talking about. Hi there, Megan.
Hi. It's nice to talk to you.
Well, thank you. You too.
I just got into the car and I was listening to your conversation, and I wanted to say that I'm an AmeriCorps member, so I don't get paid for my job, and I'm volunteering for a year, and you have to be really good and really nice, and you have to accept the fact that you just have to work really hard and love what you're doing, because if you're not, you're not going to make it through a year of doing really hard work and not getting paid. So you have to be nice and you have to be excited, and maybe at the end of that, hopefully somebody will offer you a position somewhere or something, but in at least in, you know, I just graduated college a little over a year ago and took an AmeriCorps position, and hopefully, you know, working hard and being a good person will get you somewhere. So
Megan, I'm embarrassed that you're calling, because I forgot one example that proves Adam Grant's a thesis and yours. My kid did just what you did. My 19-year-old, when she graduated high school, did a year in City Year. Obviously, it's an offshoot of what you were doing, with the exact same motivation. You know, but my sense was, Megan, is in her case, she had a whole life ahead of her. In your case, you have a whole life ahead of you. Don't you think that makes a difference? You think if you were in the workforce, dealing with a family, dealing with normal expenses, do you think your willingness to be as focused on helping others before yourself would be as high as it seems to be in your case?
Yeah, and actually in my AmeriCorps program, I'm one of the youngest people.
Really?
So people do have families, and people have, you know, quit jobs at corporate, you know, places to do a year and give a year of service. So I think the name of the game is just finding something that you really are passionate about and that you know you're doing good work that's going to mean something to someone, and that will get you through it. That will be at least in the case of the people that I have known who I have served with over the past year, that seems to be what the name of the game is. If you just love what you're doing and you know you're
Got
making
it.
A difference, that's all the motivation you
Megan,
need.
Megan, it comes through in your voice. Thank you so much for the call. So if people want to learn more about this Adam Grant character, what do they do? I mean,
well, okay, one thing I would say is he said exactly what Megan's saying to his students at Wharton the first day, and they're like, yeah, we're thinking of doing like a 35-year in career in finance, and then we'll give back to people. And he's like, yeah, maybe we should start today. So we did. He did. We will be talking about this Saturday at 10 a.m. There's a lot of fascinating stuff. It turns out you can tell from your Facebook page and from the size of the picture in a company's annual report how conceited the CEO is. Yeah, and this is fascinating.
How do you
like
tell?
When you go back and look at like Ken Lay, he had took out a full page picture. Ken Lay, the former head of
Enron.
Is that
his prison photo or is that his
pre-prison
photo?
Well, it doubled,
photo.
So that was nice because it was both. Saved a little money when he got to prison.
If it's really oversized, that's a good sign that he's a real conceited
guy.
It's a bad sign.
You
know,
sign,
by the way, I'm also thinking, I was a former legal services lawyer, where a ton of people who could have gone to Wall Street, I wasn't one of them, decided to do this for virtually nothing to help people.
And look how things worked.
Maybe
he
knows what he's talking about.
Who decided to
There were not that many Wall Street offers, I have to say. Maybe they had my address wrong. I'm not exactly sure.
Jim, do you want to ask me what's on tonight?
Yeah, what's on tonight? You actually know?
Yes.
That's shocking.
The Secrets of Happy Families tonight at 9 p.m.
We got to go. Tomorrow, the Friday News Quiz has a fish theme. Roger Berkowitz from Legal Seafoods against Bud Riss from the New England Aquarium. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Hope you're here tomorrow at noon. Bye.